You're listening to Earnestly Speaking, the only weekly podcast that covers friends, foes, and anything that goes. And now, for your badass host, Ernest Owens. And we're back for another episode of Earnestly Speaking with your host, Ernest Owens, myself. Well, it is September, and it is September, and woo, it's been a lot. Oh my goodness. This past week has been, you know, I thought that with Labor Day, you know, on Monday, and, you know, that 4-day week, that things were going to be a little bit more, you know, adjustable and adaptable. But listen, it is officially fall for me. I am in fall mode. Brand new restaurants, lots of buzz. You know, Eater has been doing well with a lot of people hype about, you know, all the new restaurants. You know, I did a piece on brand new fall restaurant openings. I also talked about the new hottest restaurants in Philadelphia right now. And, you know, it's got the streets talking and the people buzzing. So it's been just a thrill on that front. Like, it's been exciting. Super excited to be back with my students. You know, it's been almost like 2 weeks because I only teach on Mondays. And so when I, you know, we didn't have class last week because it was Labor Day. So it's been like 2 weeks away from my students. And so it's like adjusting and getting ready to, you know, go back and teach and be like, hey, you know, it's been a minute. You know, your professor is here. So that is, you know, the exciting part. But I am excited to tell you all about the book tour. I am this week, maybe on Monday, maybe, you know, maybe later, early in the half of the week. But the book tour has official dates. And if you are a listener of Earnestly Speaking, you're the first to know about them. So I'm super excited to officially announce the fall book tour dates. So wrapping up this experience, because I want to make sure I have all the dates listed one by one. But I'm excited to announce that the book tour is officially happening, starting on Thursday, September 21st. I will be in Chicago, Illinois at the Bookseller. Okay. It kicks off again Thursday, September 21st, 7 p.m. The Bookseller in Chicago, if you're in Chicago, which is my birthplace. I was born in Chicago on October 12th, 1991. At Michael Herman Hospital, and I'm coming back right before my 32nd birthday. So I'm excited to be back in the Windy City. Cannot wait to try new restaurants. One of the cool things I've been doing that I'm doing with this particular book tour and scheduling it is that I am also like going to be in conversation with incredible people. So I'll be in conversation with Mel B, who is this incredible Black podcaster journalist that is based in Chicago, and we're going to be in conversation, and then we're going to have dinner at a hot spot in Chicago. So I was looking up like really great restaurants and found this great place, and I'm like, wow, I need to go there. So following that, the following week, Wednesday, September 27th, I will be in the D, Detroit, Michigan, at Source Booksellers at 7 p.m. And I'll be in conversation with Andre Ashe, who was this incredible Black journalist who was based there at the, I believe it's the Michigan Chronicle is the publication. And we're going to be in conversation about the book as well. But that's going to be a busy week because on Sunday, October 1st at 5 p.m. at the Brooklyn Borough Hall, I'll be at the Brooklyn Book Festival in conversation about my book. It's going to be almost like a debate. There's an author who's going to be there who has a book that's against cancel culture. And my book is, of course, a different progressive spin on it. So we're going to be, you know, having a night forum discussion about our different ideas. And it's going to be at the Brooklyn Book Festival, which is one of the most highly acclaimed book festivals in America. And I'm excited. So I'll be in Brooklyn on Sunday, October 1st. I'll be actually coming in that Saturday night. So to all my folks in New York and Brooklyn that want to hang out, get drinks or do something, I'll be in town, you know, so hit me up. On Monday, October 2nd, which is literally the next day, okay, I will be in LA Los Angeles, California. I am coming back, baby. I will be there at the USC bookstore, which is my alma mater, USC. I got my master's in 2020, if you all know, in communication management. And so I'm returning back to USC. We're coming back to LA to do a incredible book signing at the USC bookstore. I'll also be doing a lot of guest lectures and pop-ins around campus. So I'm all in LA the next day. And then we're going to take a cute little break in between October, and we're going to do a special event on Wednesday, October 18th at Cheney. This will be the official book launch party event, because my book is the campus read for freshmen. Freshmen require reading, and there's going to be a cool little social event, little mixer. I'm going to have a great conversation and book talk. And sign copies, and students are going to be there. And, you know, it's going to be a good opportunity just to meet with students and also meet with the faculty. It's going to be a campus-wide event, but the public is welcome to come at Cheney on October 18th, on a Wednesday. And then we're going to wrap up on Thursday, October 24th, in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. I'll be at Rider University, and I'll be talking to students about my book, and I'm going to be doing a special guest lecture there. And that will conclude my national book tour for 2023 for the Case for Council Culture. So it's been an incredible journey. To be very clear, we're going to still be selling books and we're going to still be doing things. But as far as like the big book tour type of energy, this is the final leg. This is the third leg. Three's a charm. And after that, I'll be doing paid speaking engagements and just doing regular traveling and events. And the book will be there and I'll sign copies and do things. But the aggressive book tour that you all have seen me been doing for the past year, that will conclude this fall with this book tour. So I'm super excited about it. You know, a lot of you all, I've hit major cities. I think when I did the last count, I did 16 different cities. And I've traveled to multiple states, over a dozen states, and I've had over 20 book stops, but I've been in 16 different cities across the country, and I hit the major ones, right? Like, I've done, you know, New York, LA, Chicago, Houston, DC, Boston, Baltimore, Los Angeles, Detroit. You know, I've done all the major cities. Houston, did I say Houston? I think I said Houston. But, like, I've done a lot of cities. Like, Martha's Vineyard was fabulous, you know? And so I'm excited that, you know, I've been able to really hit this. For a debut book, for a first-time book, you all continuously buy the book, continuously show love. I'm really grateful for that. I'm really been happy with all the conversations and ideas. There's so much more to come. I have to be quiet about it, though, of course, but there's so much good things happening, and I'm just so happy that I was able to pull off another tour. I'm super excited about these cities because Chicago is like, wow, LA, Detroit. Like, I'm really excited. Like, it's the thing for me has been to be able to go to these different cities. Oh, New Orleans. How could I lose New Orleans? I forget about New Orleans. New Orleans is great too. But like, the thing that I love the most is being able to go to cities, and every place we went to, it hasn't been empty. Like, it hasn't been like crickets. Like, there are folks and people I don't even know, and people that I do know that I haven't seen in years that are like coming out and just excited about a book, right? You know, because nowadays people think that folks don't read. People still read books, y'all. I mean, I still do. I'm gonna tell you about a book I read actually this week that I had to speed read because of everything going on. But I'm happy about that. I'm happy that as a Black queer millennial, as someone in my early 30s, that I can go out on a book tour and do this. This is like the dream. Like, this is the dream. Like, when I was in college with my friends and my roommates and people used to speak this into my existence, like into my life. It was like, oh yeah, you're going to be a bookseller. You're going to be a bestseller. You're going to be traveling. You're going to be this and that. And I used to be like, yeah. But like, for real, it's happening. And it's like, while it might seem like I'm just working it in the groove, there are moments where I take a step back and I'm just like, this shit is real. Like, I have a book that's in public libraries. I have a book that's on bookshelves in places I've never been to. And people from places and people I don't know are like reading it and looking at it and consuming it and thinking about it and debating it. Like, I love that for my journalism, like when people read my articles and share it and debate it, when people see my social media posts and post it on major blogs and sites, and my friends will tag me and DM me and say, yo, you're in this room, you're in the shade room, you're in this place, your tweet is on this site. You know, I'm like, wow, you know? But it's just something about a book where people are willing to pay for it. I think that's the part for me, is like folks who I don't know are somewhere in a bookstore somewhere, and they're like, yo, this book is interesting. Like, I'm interested in this, and I'm going to drop coins. And I'm in bookstores in Philly where the book is consistently sold out. Like, I don't know if I've said it enough, but like, thank you. Like, thank you. Like, I really, from the bottom of my heart, am grateful and appreciate, like, that level of investment and commitment. And, you know, some of you all, I bump into you in the street. Some of you all have sent me letters and have, you know, all types of notes. And I read them. I'm touched by them. And I'm consistently reminded that this doesn't happen without people like you. And in the words of PBS, thank you. So I just wanted to say that because too often you get caught up in the work so much. And sometimes people may not know how much on the reciprocal end, the reception feels on my end. And so I want to let people know that I'm very appreciative and thankful for that. So just want to put that out there. So this week, NLGJA was here, the National Association for LGBTQ Journalists. They had their convention in Philadelphia. We was at the Lowe's Hotel. And I stayed at home, of course, but I went and traveled back and forth. But of course, it was a great event. I did a book reading conversation, Authors Cafe, earlier in the week to promote the case for counterculture at the convention. It was wonderful. I connected with some other LGBTQIA journalists, people like Travell Anderson, and other folks who wrote great books. And so it was great to just be around other authors and connect with people and network. And there was some card passing and some other collaborative stuff. So I'm super excited about that. I also did an incredible panel with some journalists discussing how newsrooms can better prepare to cover LGBTQI individuals. And honestly, you know, what I told those newsrooms that I want to tell regular people, folks that are not journalists, is that my solution was simple. It was like, listen, newsrooms got to understand that the way that you can include voices and diversify your stories, regardless of LGBTQIA, race, gender, whatnot, is that it's not just about the stories, right? It's also about sourcing. So some people think like increased coverage means sometimes that it's like a particular topical topic, like Pride Month or a transgender, you know, Day of Awareness or whatever, right? But I also tell people it's subtle ways. It's number one, are you hiring people? Are you diversifying your employment to have different people at different levels in the newsroom influence coverage? That's one important way. The second way, outside of just doing stories, is the stories that are not necessarily fixated on LGBTQI people, how about including sources in other stories? So one thing that I tell people is that if you think that LGBTQI people live in this bubble where all they're worried about is LGBTQIA like labeled issues, then you're missing the mark. Like outside of my work as a journalist, I'm also someone who is in the media ecosystem. I'm also somebody who is a food writer. I'm also somebody who is a college professor. I'm also someone who, you know, is a nonprofit, you know, leadership. If you're doing a story about issues impacting nonprofits, you can also call on me to be a source or call on a queer person in nonprofit leadership to be a part of that story. It doesn't have to center on our sexual orientation, gender identity. It's just simply doing it, right? I tell this about a lot of times when it comes to diversity stories around race. You know, there are newsrooms in Philadelphia and beyond that will often say, oh, well, we interviewed this, you know, we did a story on Black History Month. We did a story on this Black person. It's like, well, okay, but when I read your stories about mental health or read your stories about criminal justice reform or read your stories about politics, how many Black, you know, therapist are you interviewing as a source? How many Black, you know, political consultants are a part of your story? So I feel like the real work is don't include black people only when the headline is about that says black. It's about including black people's voices and perspectives on issues around the country and around the world that is not necessarily, you know, directed specifically at their identity in their community as a target demographic. It's recognizing that when you talk about, you know, birth control, when you talk about, you know, abortion rights, and when you talk about financial issues, that impacts black people like it impacts white people, like it impacts cishet people. Like, just include us as regular people in all of your stories outside of just specific coverage alone. So that was something that I really told them. And I think this could be information that companies can use outside of just journalism, but it's just like normalize including people from marginalized backgrounds in everything that you do so that it doesn't have to be a lot of pressure on representation only when it's Black History Month, Pride Month, Latino Heritage Month. You don't have to feel like you have to fuck it up or mess it up or get it right if you was doing it 365. So that was my feedback I gave to them. Outside of that, I won my lovely award in person, which I was super excited about. I had won the Association of LGBTQ Journalists. I won Excellence in Long-Form Journalism for my work on Jussie Smollett, the piece I did for Rolling Stone, which was called Jussie Smollett Wanted to Be a Hero. Instead, he destroyed his career. And you all remember the drama behind that story. And, you know, my interactions and relationship with Jussie Smollett, how it deteriorated during my journey of covering him during the trial. And, you know, it was a gutsy story. I'm proud of it. I'm proud that, you know, I was honored. You know, I've been saying on social media that, you know, 7 consecutive years I've been snubbed. But it's all love with LGGA. Their president, Kim Miguel, is awesome. I spoke to the executive director, their team, and there's a lot of love and there's a lot of good vibes. And, you know, I'm just happy that when I look on my shelf, that I have awards from both of the journalism associations that I identify with. you know, this year I won an NABJ Journalism Award and I won an NLGGA Award for two separate pieces from two separate publications. I'm that bitch. No, I'm joking, but for real, for real. That makes me feel good. For a long time, I felt like there were certain organizations like NLGGA that always looked at my journalism like, oh, he's covering for the black community. But I was always and have always written stories that was in the intersections of both my sexual orientation, gender identity, and my race, right? And so I'm happy that these various organizations can see between the intersections of my work and honor them appropriately. So that is touching. And that was, it was a great moment for me to be able to receive that award. Members from my PBJ executive board and my membership showed up and showed out. My good friends came through from that leadership team to show up. It was at 9 a.m. in the morning at the Lowe's. So some of y'all are going to be like, why y'all didn't call me? I would have came. Y'all, it was 9 a.m. Even I wasn't trying to really get up, to be honest. But we got up, we did our thing, and we had brunch at Bank and Bourbon, which is like downstairs at the Lowe's Hotel. It's like their hotel restaurant, but it's dope. I got something to say about that brunch in a minute. But we had a great brunch, and it was a good time. But after I received my award, you know, I'm ready to, you know, tell y'all some things because, you know, the streets are talking. Y'all been seeing what's been going on, okay? And, you know, it's some interesting things and some aftermath. So, you know, I showed up. I was there. My team pulled up because we were notified that at the NLGJ ceremony where I got recognized that there was going to be a panel plenary discussion about healing, transformation, and truth. And that on this panel, the president of NABJ, the new president, Ken Lemon, was going to be a part of the panel. Now, a lot of y'all are like, "Woo, what happened? Whoa, it's about to get hot." Okay, it's about to get a little hot. What happened was that we got notified that Ken was coming the day before. People who've been following the situation between us, PABJ and NABJ, said, look, Ken is in Philly. And, you know, folks been like, you know, it's been, you know, I want to backtrack a little bit. Earlier this week, the National Association of Black Journalists released a statement that basically confirmed everything that we talked about last week. So remember last week, y'all, I told y'all about how there was a group of people that were conspiring to create another NABJ Philly under my back and tried to slide this organization in, and that NABJ was in talks to come to Philadelphia at the meeting in October. They were trying to have their own private meeting with their board and all this drama, right? Well, that got confirmed officially earlier this week. NABJ put out a statement, and they basically said that they were in talks to bring another NABJ Philly into the city, which is just, again, stupid, because we already have an organization here that's 300 members strong. And even though there was a split, there was always other options and solutions. And I feel like we would be better off as a group having a conversation about how to fix men's than bring a whole new group into the mix that is not prepared to tackle these issues. They don't have any money. They don't have any real clout. And quite frankly, they appear to be antagonistic to the progress that's being made by the current organization. So for that, you know, when the press release came out, we were just like, this is ridiculous. So we were like, okay, well, now that Ken is here, we're going to, you know, pull up, because we had, you know, tried to send emails to this board. We tried to do previous times and we wasn't getting responses. And so at the event, you know, I felt like it was important because I was triggered. You know, I was triggered by hearing, you know, this man at the time talk about, truth and talk about, you know, healing and all of these things. But you literally was on a board as the vice president that voted in, at the time, voted in favor of me being removed as the first person in this organization to be removed. And I'm a Black queer journalist, and you came to my city and you couldn't even respectfully, you know, offer a conversation. And so I expressed in front of that entire delegation, in front of the entire NLGJ community, they gave me the mic. And you know, me and a mic are like gin and tonic. So I spoke my truth in front of all of those people, in front of him, man to man, and told him, you know, basically that what he is doing right now is disrespectful, it is hypocritical, that it is harmful, and that as a Black queer journalist who's a member of NLGGA, to see him sit up here and talk like this while not addressing these issues within his own organization was problematic. And I asked and demanded for a meeting and told him, when would he do it? I mean, of course, his response was very much like, oh, my number's been available and, you know, I'm always free to talk. And when are you free to talk? And on site, I said, we can talk. Well, let's talk tomorrow. And at that time, that was Sunday. What I will tell you is that we did have a conversation. It took 2 years. And I made it clear to him, and I've made it clear to everybody, that PABJ is willing to be in affiliation with NABJ. And that if said affiliation means that we will not be in compliance with some of the current policies that has made it difficult for us to do so, then so be it on compliance. But at the end of the day, if affiliation can help mend some of this drama, let's do it. And it's something that not only I agree with, it's what the members want. The members that are actually a part of PABJ, let me be clear, it is what the board wants. It's what we all want here in Philadelphia. We don't need a bootleg PABJ. We don't need a, you know, counterfeit bag. Like, we don't need no fake Gucci bags up in here. We don't need no knockoffs. There's no need to have a knockoff PABJ. You know, we don't. I remember on Love & Hip Hop, because I love Love & Hip Hop, Stevie J was calling Nico, who was messing around with his ex-girlfriend, Mimi, his baby mama. He said, you know, who's this knockoff Stevie J? And I just keep thinking that in my head when I be like, a knockoff PABJ. Like, what is this? This is a bootleg PABJ. This is a knockoff PABJ. We don't need no fake counterfeits. And let me be also clear, and let me reiterate for those who didn't listen to last week's podcast, which you can, it's still available, is that the people at the helm of this do not live in Philadelphia. They live in Jersey. They live in Delaware. They live out of state. These are individuals who are not comfortable. Most of them, a few have, naming their allegiance and involvement in this. They are fearful. They will not respond back to the board. They have not spoken back to the board. They have not, you know, we offered to have a conversation with them. We said to them, we would like to have a conversation to address these issues. And a lot of them honestly did not, none of them responded. None of them said, you know what, I'm going to put all my issues aside. I want to explain to you why I was involved in this situation. And, you know, I'm going to hear it, right? They haven't done that. And so, you know, I do believe to some extent there is some bad faith involved in this, clearly. And it's like, do you really want to work this out, or did you just want to usurp or attempt to usurp power? And so I tell people, be very mindful that it's, you know, we always assume the best in people, which we should. But when you're dealing with pure evil, when you're dealing with people that just want to be chaotic, ain't no negotiating that. But that is those individuals. And I think what we made clear is that Philadelphia doesn't want another NABJ chapter. When the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists has been here since 1974, and I don't mean the Sun NABJ, but I'm going to do it for 5 seconds. PABJ is the first association of its kind for Black journalists in America. We were the first. Period. There was no NABJ before PABJ. We predate them. We are the blueprint. We are the alpha, and we're the omega. We are the first to do it, baby. And to be quite honest, let's talk about history. Nearly 50 years ago, our members, our founding fathers and mothers, went to DC, in addition to other journalists, and created NABJ in 1975. So how are you going to kick out the mother of the house? We're the mother. We're the one that started it all. And we will never be duplicated. Nobody can copy our swag and our recipe. And there are some longtime members who lived in that era that are a part of this decision. And I will tell them respectfully, what you don't want to do is think for 5 seconds that you can replace the legacy of the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists. And so I made that clear to the current NABJ president, that there's a better option on the table than this, because this is the nuclear option. And we ain't trying to go there, because I don't need to go from 0 to 100. Let's stay at 60. Okay, maybe 65, but still, let's stay there. We don't need to go to 100 on this, because cooler heads can prevail. And I'm coming in here with an olive branch of grace. The board is, the membership wants to see us move in a positive direction. And listen, we can do that. And they know that. And I've articulated that to them. So we'll see what happens. But at the end of the day, Philadelphia and PABJ is going to keep moving forward. And I let it be known to some of the board members that it gets silly in Philly when it comes to fuckery. And this is bananas. This is unnecessary. We don't have to do this. And it gets silly in Philly. And I just feel like, in my opinion, I made this clear to the president of NABJ, that I think that he is getting the wrong impression about Philadelphia and about what Black journalists want. And also how important PABJ is to not only Philadelphia, but to America. And that this attempt that they're doing is attempting to undermine the legacy and the respect of this organization. And when you mess with Philly, you mess with everyone. It gets silly in Philly. And people do not have time for somebody to parachute their, because you know how Philly do, y'all, for those who listen to this very Philly podcast. Nobody in Philly likes national folks parachuting into their city, trying to dictate and represent their city's interests. Philadelphia and PABJ is not just a Black journalist concern. It is a city council concern. It is a concern from activists. It is it's a nonprofit concern. It is a newsroom concern. We are backed and supported across the city from people that these outside voices don't know nothing about. And if you thought that my appearance and calling out the bullshit at that conference is the very maximum I would do, guess again, because we're not here for the games. We're not here for the passive aggressiveness. We're not here for the throwing stones and hiding hands. And a lot of these people, because I call them the hateful eight. I ain't going to hold you. I'm a little petty. But I call these eight people the hateful eight. Because to me, this is hateful. This is spiteful. And honestly, what's funny to me is I could see if I was burning the house down. I could see if we were broke. I could see if memberships were going down. I could see if fundraising wasn't here. I could see if my events were flops. I could see if that was the case. But I didn't do that. My board didn't do that. And so it's hard for me to not look at this as people bucking against the current generation of journalists that are trying to move the organization forward. It's hard for me not to see this as an attack on my age. It's hard not to see this as an attack on who I am as a Black queer person, right? Because the way in which these people have discussed me and described me to other leaders has given off the impression that there is homophobia influencing this, that there is paternalism involving this, that there is elitism shaping this, and that these are people who are so stubborn and so stuck in their ways. It will never be 1974 anymore. PBJ will never stick in 1974. The good old days, as they would put it, are over for them. We are in a new era that's more inclusive. See, they don't like the fact that the old school journalists of the day wanted journalists to be working in traditional newsrooms and working for the traditional press. So if you was a Black journalist and you didn't work at the Philadelphia Inquirer or Philadelphia Magazine or, you know, WQHS, well, WHYY, or any of these like major, you know, media companies or whatever, and you didn't work at NBC 10 or CBS 3 and all the major, 6 ABC, they didn't consider you a journalist. And to be honest, they didn't even care about the Black press. They didn't recognize, you know, WRD as much as they should have. They didn't honor and recognize the Tribune or other Black media as much as they should have. I'm not saying they didn't do it, but they didn't do it enough. They were very much elitist. They were caught up in the framing of, oh, you're at the Inquirer. You're a serious journalist. Ooh, you at Philly Mag. Listen, let me tell y'all a little story. When I was a freelancer, I'm still a freelancer by contract, but like when I was a freelancer new to the city and my first gig was at Metro Philly, right? When I was at the free paper, I remember some of these Black journalists waving their noses at me being like, oh, okay. And I knew what that meant. That was dismissing me and who I was. The moment I got to Philly Mag, all of a sudden, the conversation changed. All of a sudden, they viewed me as a real journalist. They looked at me like I mattered. You know, it's the same elitism that I experienced when I went to college, right? Like, I went to Penn, and when I told people I was in college, they were like, okay, cool. But then when I said I went to Penn, University of Pennsylvania, it was like, oh, okay. Oh, you're smart. But what if I would have said I was at CCP? What if I would have said I was at Westchester? Like, it's that type of elitism that's been in this institution for a while. And as Black journalists, we know what's going on in this industry. People are getting laid off. People are transitioning into different careers. We have a lot of journalists that are doing experimental things. They're creating new publications. They're creating online publications. You got people like Josh Duncan creating Love Now Media. And there needs to be a place, right? When I became president of PBJ, I created a space so that people like Josh Duncan can be in the media conversation in PBJ. Because for a long time, if you would have fast forward to like 10, 15 years ago, people would have frowned on people like Josh Duncan. Like, they would have been like, oh, she's at Love Now Media. What is that? We don't care about that. There are a lot of Black people in Philadelphia that's creating brand new media companies and organizations. And they're telling me for the first time in years, I never thought I could be a PABJ member until you was the president. I always felt like I was judged if I was not working at these major publications. I thought there was no space for me, that there was no place for me if I wasn't at KYW versus WRD. And so when I became president, that opened the doors for different type of storytellers and journalists to come into the organization. And then when they came into the organization, some of the old school journalists, right, some that retired, some that were veterans, walked in this space and was just kind of like, oh, who is that? I don't know who this person is. That's not a real journalist. Like, they really, like, raised their nose up to these members. And so I had to choose between the new leadership and the new membership vibes that was coming, or honoring the elite dated system and acquiesce to the powers that be of the past. And we bumped heads because I chose to move into the future and not 1974. So there's a lot of intergenerational problems. There's a lot of microaggressions. There's a lot of paternalism. There's a lot of that that's taking this route, because these people are so stubborn that they're like, I don't want to work and serve under someone younger than me. I don't want to serve under an entrepreneurial journalist that isn't, you know, a part of my rigid definition of what a journalist should be. I don't want that. So they would rather overturn and try to upsert current leadership to do what they want to do rather than move forward in the future. So wrapping this up, I spoke to the new president. We'll see where it goes, but that's it. You know, there's a line in the sand. It's time for people to play and pick a position. And it's time for people to get real about the current times we're in. There's bigger fish to fry right now than Black people in media fighting each other over organizations that honestly Black people need to be united. It's time. And I'm ready to do it. And PABJ is ready to do it. And I don't know what they're trying to do, but if they're saying to people that they're trying to create an inclusive, open space, it starts with confronting the elephant in the room and the problems that may take shape. That's all. So earlier this week, I was at the Crystal T Ballroom. Michael Nutter was being, you know, former Mayor Michael Nutter was being honored with this award from the World Heritage Foundation. They were honoring for him for his work, and it was a great time. And people saw me there. I was there with my bestie, Sharon. And it was a nice event, and it was interesting because, you know, it reminds me that this upcoming Thursday, I will be back in City Hall for City Council Live on WRD, okay? It's going to be exciting. I can't wait. We're back on. The show is back on. You know, we're back in session. City Council is back in session. So I have a lot to look forward to on Thursday. It's from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. on WRD Radio. Okay. You know, our station is lit. It is, of course, 96.1 FM, 900 AM, Black Talk Media. And it's going to be a great conversation. There's a lot going on in City Council. You know, they took the summer break. You know, we got to figure out what's going on with Chinatown, with council member Mark Squilla. Like, what are we going to do about Chinatown, right? The 76ers arena situation. Like, let's see what's going to happen there. What's going to happen with council president? You know, everybody and their mother seems like they want to be running for council president. So I'm excited to see how these conversations are going to move with Philadelphia's budget, what's going on with people on council, what's going on with the mayor's race. We're going to talk a little bit about what happened recently with the drama there. And we're going to really look into what's happening. So I'm looking forward to everything that's happening with that. And it's just great to just see people working together. Shout out to a couple of places I ate this week. Some of y'all saw some great pictures. Tallulah's Garden. I want to talk about that first because that food was incredible. So I know there's a lot of new restaurants in the fall. I know there's a lot of stuff going on, but sometimes you just want to have classics. So me and Mr. Johnson went out for dinner on Saturday night. We had the loveliest time. We went to Lulu's Garden, which is in Washington Square West. And it was fabulous. It was a great meal. It was just a great meal. I had the steak. We shared a lamb pasta. Mr. Johnson had branzino, which was great. We had the meatballs, which were phenomenal. We had tuna tartare. The cocktails, it was so many great cocktails. We even had wine. It was dope. It was just a really great dinner. So intimate, so sweet, so romantic. Really loved it. And I'm loving the fact that I can just eat steak medium rare and not pass out. So just kudos to me for that, because I'm just loving my steak medium rare now. I can't eat it any other way now. Bank and Bourbon. Let me talk about Bank and Bourbon. So Bank and Bourbon is a cute little bar, but let me tell you about brunch. Brunch at Bank and Bourbon is lit. They have a brunch buffet, and they're located at the Lowe's around 12th and Market over there at the Lowe's, right across the street from the Marriott. And Bank and Bourbon has like one of the best brunch situations in the city. I didn't even know. It just crept under my nose. It's like they have a brunch buffet, $32 per person. And it is the most scrumptious, generous brunch ever. They have egg white frittatas, scrambled eggs, bacon, sausage, salmon and lox bagel spread, a smoothie bar, croissants and pastries, breakfast potatoes, salad bar station, fruit station, Danish station, everything. It was smoke. Oh, they even had overnight oats. I mean, it was like the most bountiful brunch I've been to in a while. It was so good. 32 per person. And also, they have this bottle special where they're having a bottle they're having bottle service where it's like you can get a whole bottle of champagne and all the chasers and mixers at, you know, for $40. Now, to you, you might think, is that cheap? Is that a good deal? Is that not? Let me put it this way. Their mimosas were $13. A whole bottle of champagne with three different chasers, and you can serve as much as you want, to me, is a deal. Because it was good, you know. It was good. It was just the bomb. I highly recommend this brunch. It was dope. The other place I went to, which I'm super excited to talk about too, was Pod. Mr. Johnson and I did a nice, lovely, romantic Sunday supper at Pod. I'm going to call it Pod Reloaded. They have Kevin Yanga, who used to be at Izakaya by Yanga in Fishtown. Well, Kevin Yanga is now at Pod. Pod has a special place in my heart because Pod in 2010 was the first dinner party I did in Philly. I went to Penn, as you all know. Pod was right next to campus, right over there on Sansom, around Sansom. And I just was like amazed by how cool and dope this place was. And this is back in 2010, this Stephen Starr restaurant. And I was excited about it. And then I guess around the pandemic time, you know, Stephen Starr was like, we're going to do K-Pod, which was this Korean concept, which I never fully got into. I just never was fully sold on K-Pod. Like, they had a cool dessert with sweet potato that was really good. But I just never felt like K-Pod was just like, it made sense to me, like a concept. It was okay concept, but I missed the old Pod. Well, y'all, this Pod is new and improved. It is something different. I mean, it's so good. I got a spread of all their different entrees. It is good. It deserves a revisit. I encourage you to go back and revisit Pod now that it has a new chef and a new team. But Stephen Starr made the right choice. I highly agree with the choice. I'm happy he did it. Who would ever thought this would happen? But it's genius and it's smart and the food is delicious. Just want to put that out there. So moving along into some of these hot topics that's happened, I got a chance to read the book, The Last Politician, Inside Joe Biden's White House and the Struggle for America's Future by Frank Foer. This book is spicy. If you haven't read it, I encourage you to get the audiobook, do whatever. But it's a really good book. And it's complicated. It's a complicated book because, you know, I walked away from it, you know, thinking about like, I don't want to say this right now, but it's like, I don't know about Joe Biden running for re-election. I'm indifferent. And apparently many Democrats want Joe Biden to kind of just like pass the torch. I know Joe wants to be a second term president, but like there's something right now. We got to have a different Gavin Newsom from California, people, anyone. Like we just have to have, I just don't know if Biden is really a good option. Like, I understand that Trump remains popular in spite of all of his 90-plus indictments, charges, or whatever. But at the end of the day, okay, if Biden wins by a hair or whatever, is anything really materially going to change or get better for the country at the level to which we need it? And is it possible for us to respectfully switch leaders during this time for the betterment of the country? Unfortunately, American politics just does not work that way. And it's frustrating because I'm kind of like, could we have considered a different option? I don't know. But it's just going to need to be a better, stronger leadership team under Biden then. So if you want to keep Biden as president, the team just got to be stronger. And, you know, with Kamala, it's like, one of the things that interested me about the book was that it really shed a light on the relationship between Obama and Biden when Biden was the vice president. Contrary to a lot of the conversations around, oh, they were best friends, Batman and Robin with aviator shades, they were very different, and sometimes that clashed. You know, Biden was more of a blue-collar, you know, white man, older man, who had a different type of way of engaging in politics. Biden was a constitutional law professor from an Ivy League school, and I want to say Biden is one of the first presidents in, well, he's one of the few presidents in modern history that did not graduate with an advanced degree and also did not graduate from an Ivy League institution. He went to the University of Delaware. Like, he did not get a master's degree or a bachelor's degree. You know, he didn't get a law degree. He didn't come from that kind of background. And he also didn't come from the Ivy League. And I think that makes sense that, like, you're dealing with a black man that is arguably smarter than you, and your older white man who has a history of at times making racially insensitive remarks, and you're having to work under someone younger than you and smarter than you and have a different kind of swag. And so by default, are we really surprised that their relationship was a little more complicated than what we expected? Not so much now, because it makes sense in retrospect that that's the nature. But you know what I will say is that one thing I appreciate about them is that in spite of these issues they had, they did have a level of civility and respect where the vice president was the vice president and the president was the president. I think right now, you know, the relationship between Kamala and Biden just seems to be so on opposite sides. I don't think for 5 seconds they don't respect each other or like each other. I just don't know if there's a real genuine chemistry here that allows Kamala to be emboldened to make some strong decisions and advise the president. And I also don't know if Biden's in the space or his team's in the space to work through this drama. It's a lot of questions and interesting observations. But one of the things that Kamala has been doing lately, and this brings me to my next point, is there's been a lot of conversations about Kamala's, you know, popularity again. And she's been doing a lot of interesting things to try to get that there. So this past weekend, she had a 50th anniversary of hip hop party at her residence. And Lil Wayne was singing Mrs. Officer, which is hilarious, that song, Mrs. Officer, because Kamala's a cop, or was a cop, or, you know, the narrative around her being, you know, affiliated with law enforcement. And I find that to be a subtle dig in its own unique way. Kamala was dancing to the song and vibing. I don't know if Lil Wayne was singing the Be Like a Cop and introduced the ridiculous, offensive, you know, Rodney King reference in the sexual innuendo between Beat It Like a Cop. Like, this, the innuendo of, like, the sexual innuendo around that, and then the reference to Rodney King, and then the idea of beating something up like a cop. Like, I just... And I'm wondering to myself, like, Kamala, do you understand what is happening here? Like, Vice President, do you recognize what's happening in the context? And she doesn't, sadly. There was also other performances. But the thing that gets me about the current White House, especially some of these parties and things, just saying, is that there seems to be the same crowds and people. Like, Jason Lee is there. Interesting. Like, there's this need to keep bringing and inviting the same class elite folks into the conversation. And, you know, these people are not going to get you elected, reelected. I just want to say that. That if you think that these are going to be the people that's going to get you reelected, I would like you to reconsider that. That a lot of those folks, some of those folks, have their own self-interests, and a lot of that can be arguably considered grifty. And it's interesting because when I look at the people that's getting invited to those type of parties, some of the people, not all of them, of course, but when I look at some of the people that's getting invited, I'm just like, Kamala, do you really think that these are the people that are going to be holding it down for you when a lot of these people are using their proximity to the White House to validate a lot of the disgusting, problematic things that they do with their platforms? But if that's, you know, it's funny because people will sit up all day and act like, you know, oh, they have a standard at the White House, and Ernest, you're too controversial, and you're too this, and you're too that. And I have to take that moment to push back and say, you know, I used to believe that, but it's hard for me to believe that right now, given the fact that Jason Lee is there. And if y'all know about Jason Lee, then you wouldn't even be fixing your mouth to act like there's no room for a person like me or different types of journalists to be there, per se, given some of the folks that was in that room, including the person that sat up there and got pardoned by Trump and criticized the Democratic Party. You got him on the stage thinking about being like a cop and referring Mrs. Officer and really hinting at you, Kamala, and you're accepting that. Well, you know what? There you go. Just saying, Mrs. Officer. Moving along. So, another thing that took place over the week, there was a controversy locally, a mayoral email scandal, to be honest. And, you know, I have thoughts about this across the board, and people have been wanting to know what I think because I have been included in the conversation, and I want to be sure that, you know, everyone gets a chance to be a part, you know, to understand the nuances of the situation. So I want to talk about that. You know, there's a story that got published at Billy Penn referring to leaked emails. The headline is, leaked emails from Parker's campaign show contempt for local media, journalists say. One of the messages mistakenly forwarded to Hallminer suggested the outlet's reach was too small to warrant granting requests. So there was an email faux pas from Sherelle Parker's campaign. You all know she's a Democratic nominee to run for mayor. She's many people predict that she's going to win because history for the past over 50 years has shown us that Democrat nominees win. So that's just that. She's going against David O, who is currently also running as a Republican running in his race. So there was an email faux pas that happened. And pretty much what happened was that members of Sherelle Parker's campaign were trading emails through late August and September discussing how to delay interview requests from Denise Clay Murray, who's a black journalist and a member of PBJ, and Lawrence McGlynn, who's a white journalist, who's a part of the Philadelphia Hall Monitor. Now, this is being reported by Billy Penn. You should definitely read the story to check out what was going on. So they, the Philadelphia Hall Monitor was founded by a pair of journalists with consumer advocate Lance Hover. The Philadelphia Hall Monitor is a very new local publication that is very, very new. I think they're less than a year old. But basically, they're covering City Hall and what's going on in City Council and another politics race. And so, you know, they've been trying to get a foot in the door covering some of the issues that impacts Philadelphians. So there was an oops because somebody actually copied Lawrence McGlynn to the email chain by mistake, and that gave up the strategy that these two members had trying to, you know, delay. So what was said in the emails was, let's push her off without letting her know, which is what senior advisor Aaron Platt wrote in reference to Denise Clay Murray, and said, and then, you know, basically gave this language on how advising the communication director, John Dolan, about this. And basically Denise said in the conversation he said back was, Denise, I'm working on getting this schedule. Give me a week or so. And then after receiving the conversation and discussing it with colleagues, Lawrence wrote this column and he shared the email. He talked about it and shared screenshots of it and exposed it on his platform. And the headline went, Sherelle Parker does not care about local media. And, you know, they updated the story with a statement by Sherelle Parker. But I want to, you know, get to what was also at hand. So basically, they said that, in this quote, said that in this article in the Hall Monitor site, said that, you know, Democratic nominee Sherelle Parker has been conspicuously absent from the campaign trail. It's been rare to see her publicly and rare to see, to still hear her speak substantively on any political issue. Here at Hall Monitor, we have been attempting to schedule time to speak with Sherelle Parker since May. When we have received a response from to our inquiries, we have been politely pushed off. Last week, the campaign manager called me to discuss possible interview dates. I asked for an interview for this week's show. He responded to me via email looking for a date in October. Fine, I said, we can do that on Thursday. You know, Ramos introduced me to the campaign, spoke new spokesperson John Dolan, and there was an introduction. And basically, that's when things got a little surprising with the rhetoric and the language. And so, you know, Aaron Platt had said, let's push her off without letting her know. Denise, I'm working on getting this scheduled. Give me a week or so, etc. Just be careful because she's already said that we're ignoring Black women journalists and truly independent media, irrespective of other concerns. But we don't want this to be much of a narrative. Dolan said, let me talk with Denise Clay Murray tomorrow. She wants to do a profile, and we just answered a bunch of questions for her. Obviously, defer to Aaron, but I'm disinclined to do all of the requests from both Denise and Lawrence for pieces that won't get coverage. So, you know, they pushed, you know, the Hall Monitor has been upset about this. They've talked about how they feel like the slow roll was insulting, and, you know, they're hurt by this. And, you know, I get that. So where I stood on it was, I had a conversation with Denise Clay Murray. You know, I let her know, you know, I was aware of the issues and that I want, you know, I'm the president of the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists. So, you know, anytime there's an issue that happens to our members or to Black journalists at large, we try to, you know, engage if that's something that's desired. Denise Clay Murray expressed her highest enthusiasm for me to help advocate and come to the table and get to the bottom of this. And that's what I did. Now, there was a statement released, because I want to be clear, I spoke with mayoral candidate Sherelle Parker, you know, on Thursday night when this controversy went down. And listen, it was late at night, but people were tired. People had to go to bed. But you know what? I did that because that's what leaders do. I will tell you that Sherelle was very frustrated and angry about this. She doesn't, you know, what they did, the two individuals, did not reflect what she wanted to do, that her views and values. Because remember, she came to the PABJ Media Professional Awards in May and promised that Black journalists would have a seat at the table and that, you know, there would be representation and whatnot. And so this makes it look like she's a hypocrite. And I think that her campaign team, you know, just really, I think, was trying to prioritize her, but did not realize the optics of the situation. So I want to say this before I get into the statement, but, like, you know, this is something that happens all the time. I just want to be very clear. Like, this is not an isolated incident to Sherelle's campaign. You know, communication directors do this to everybody, every journalist, everyone. And we can agree that, we could all agree that really the press should have access. Like, that should be the case. But, you know, in a reality, there is a lot, and I'm not saying this is a good thing. I'm not defending this. I'm just telling y'all who want to understand how the media industry works that, because let me, let me land, because I have so many thoughts. This is something that happens often. Everybody does, like, do this. Like, there are, the reality is that every elected official or any person, right, any public figure, has a limited number of hours in a day. And if they're too busy responding to every inquiry that comes from the media, they're not going to have an opportunity to do their jobs. They're not going to have an opportunity to do campaigning. And that it's important to note that in this situation, media, even as a journalist, I know this because I've done this, that everybody's not going to get the same level of attention and access to public figures. For example, I would love to have a conversation with President Joe Biden. I'm a journalist. I'm in Philadelphia. This man comes to Philadelphia a lot. But you know what? Because I am working for a more local publication, like Philadelphia Magazine, they don't necessarily, the communications director do not necessarily feel like I am a top priority. They would rather have local TV broadcast stations do it rather than me at my little Philadelphia publication. And guess what? That's how it's been, right? Like, and outside of elected officials, celebrities do this, like Beyonce. Beyonce is not going to talk to every single publication that wants to interview with her. Okay, she's going to talk to the New York Times. She's going to talk to Vogue. And honestly, Beyonce hardly does interviews. But like when she do, she do it for like Vogue, New York Times, you know, the big dogs. And so in this industry, there is big dog, little dog energy. And we need to stop acting like that's not the reality. It's fucked up at times and it's frustrating. But let's be clear of the dynamic. And I'll give you an example. Sometimes people want to avoid publications that they feel like, you know, is not going to be read. So it's like if Sherelle Parker is having 5,000 different meetings and there is a more niche publication that's like, we want to do an interview with you. If you are somebody who just came out of the hospital with a concerning health situation, you're trying to prioritize meetings with various places, maybe having a direct interview with one particular publication may not be priority at that moment. And, you know, to some extent, it doesn't mean the person isn't communicating with other journalists. One of the things, in my opinion, that has been a, I think, slightly unfair narrative that's been said about the campaign is that, oh, she's not talking to anyone, she's been hiding. As somebody who's also been covering this election, I don't necessarily think Sherelle Parker is hiding. I think Sherelle is having particular meetings in the community. She's in public spaces. She's at an event, right? She was at Dwight Evans had a public cookout on Sunday, had a cookout on Sunday, and committee people in the public was having pictures and engagement. I have been seeing Sherelle at events. I have been following the schedule. I've had a meeting with Sherelle Parker. I've spoken to her outside of the drama. And so I think that we need to be real that, and I'm not saying people are doing this, but you know, it might be imperative to go out to these public events. And sometimes you got to roll up on politicians. If you don't want to have the email situation, right? Because let's be real, everybody's doing that. Helen Gim's people have done that to me. And you know what? A lot of the progressives that want to get on here and come after Sherelle, there's plenty to critique with Sherelle on her criminal justice policies and the things she said during her campaign. But what I am not going to do is sit up and act like she's the only person, well, let me clarify because this was not her, but her team isn't the only ones that have done this. It's been done. It's the norm of how all of this works. I had to fight
to get an interview with Kamala Harris. And let me also be clear that from what I heard in the conversation with Sherelle, and also what has been said in the article on Hall Monitor, is that they have sent questions to the campaign, and the campaign has sent them responses from Sherelle. But apparently that wasn't enough. They wanted to have an interview. They wanted to have this one-on-one. And while that is admirable for the Hall Monitor, what we cannot ignore is that, yo, everybody may not get a one-on-one interview with a candidate. I wanted to have a one-on-one conversation with Helen Gim directly about when she went to the Union League. And guess what? I was denied the opportunity to do that. Jeff Brown wasn't really trying to talk to me, even though I was doing the investigative journalism to confront him on issues. Jeff Brown's team wasn't really trying to have the one-on-ones kind of thing. And I understood that because sometimes people, when you do adversarial journalism, you have to realize that you're not going to have sometimes the same access. And let's not act shocked by it. But at the end of the day, they fucked up because the emails and the communication went public. And so at the end of the day, they got an answer to it. What I did as president was to make sure that I can have an opportunity to, you know, I can have an opportunity to somewhat get to the bottom of some of this. And what I can tell you is that, from my understanding, the campaign is going to give Denise Clay Murray her interview. She's going to have her interview. They're going to, you know, communicate other things to her. But I wanted to make sure that it wasn't just about, on my end of communication, fixating on just Denise Clay Murray, but getting the commitment from Sherelle Parker that this will not happen again. And also to make sure that, because I'm the president and I represent Denise, and I was advocating on behalf of Denise and the other Black journalists in my organization, I wanted to make sure that not only was Denise granted access, but other Black journalists within my organization was going to get a fair shot and get access as well. And that was reiterated to me and confirmed to me. And, you know, I'm going to take it, I'm going to judge her not by her words, but by her actions. That is something that she has often said, is to judge me not by my words, but my actions. And she made it clear to me that in this statement, I'm going to read it. To say that I'm pissed and angry is an understatement. The dismissive tone of my staff is not consistent with who I am or what I expect from my team. And I've made it clear that this is entirely unacceptable. However, I understand the buck stops with me and I take responsibility for what comes out of my campaign. I've talked this evening with the president of the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists, Ernest Owens, to make my position clear and reiterate my commitment to giving a seat at the table to those who have been historically excluded. But as I've said countless times, judge me by my actions. After my election night medical emergency, when the doctor said I was not yet okay to come out of my house, I made it a priority to go to the PABJ event to reaffirm my commitment to ensuring that Black journalists will have unprecedented access in the Parker administration. This is how I've always run my office, and this is how I plan to govern if it's God's will and I am elected mayor of Philadelphia. So I look forward to seeing what happens next. You know, I'm not here trying to cover for anybody because I ain't on nobody's campaign and I ain't getting paid for no one to do any type of consulting. So let me be clear there. I ain't no puppet, ain't paid. Y'all know me. But I'm at a point where I'm sick of the Twitter or X back and forth on Twitter with people arguing. Because at the end of the day, journalists, Black journalists like Denise Clay Murray needs to do their job. And while it is, I could spend hours belaboring on how messed up this is, I recognize that my job is to make sure that my members get what their demands are and understand that, move forward. Denise Clay Murray was pleased about how I moved forward on advocating on her behalf. And she understands that this is not an end all be all, but to start to move things in the right direction. And that's what I did on my end. And so to the people that want to sit up and pick fight all day and nitpick all day, you could do that. But at the end of the day, you don't have none of our jobs. and you're not having your responsibilities. And you can be all day and throw mud and throw shots and be a Billy Badass on Twitter. But guess what? People still got to work and get jobs and get shit done right here at home in Philly. And that's what my priority is. It's time to grow up, people. We're in a crisis. Okay, we have a leadership crisis, we have a gun violence crisis, we have a poverty unemployment crisis, we have a lot going on. And I think some of these progressives who sit up and talk all day about how they're trying to move the needle forward, they just are so salty and still bitter that Helen Gim is not the fucking mayoral candidate. Get over it. Like, we have to move the fuck on. This is a new reality. And like, if are we all happy about every single political decision? Absolutely not. But you know what? I, as a Black queer person that's being targeted in this city and in this country, I don't have time to be dealing with motherfuckers who are focused on bike lanes and eating, you know, new bagels in gentrified neighborhoods. I'm focused on making sure people like me can get a fucking job and can keep my job and to be protected and have the right to practice my First Amendment rights of free speech. Like, there's a bigger fish to fry. And if you want to get on Twitter all day and belabor what could have, should have been, then you're missing the mark. And so for people like me who are pragmatic, who understand that Twitter is not the only outlet to enact change, and that using and weaponizing the experiences that happen to Black women to push other political incentives and issues is tacky. One of the things that disgusted me were how people were in comments, you know, having opinions and saying, well, you need to do a debate with David O. What does that got to do with this situation? But it's just obvious that people never really give a fuck about journalists until it serves their needs. Because when I was out here getting lied on and disrespected by the Helen Gim communications camp, none of these progressives say anything because that was who they liked. So let's be real. Everybody has teams and picks sides, and everybody likes to act like what their person do is better than the other or worse than the other. Like, when Helen Gim took her ass to the Union League, y'all was crickets in that motherfucker. Y'all was silent as shit. Okay? Listen. I see y'all. Everybody see y'all. And if I name names, y'all gonna be in y'all feelings. But, like, you know who a lot of these white progressives are that oftentimes suck up the life of conversations, love to jump on Black people's issues, but stay silent on their faves, and oftentimes only get in the conversation around race and other issues when it involves people like theirs is not in fire. So when Helen Gim makes faux pas and mistakes that are insensitive, no one is saying sorry. No, well, she said sorry, but nobody else on her support her can admit that that was wrong. They'll come up with 1,000 excuses out their ass, but then they'll get mad when Sherrill Parker people do the same thing. And it's like, okay, so y'all recognize y'all the same people, just for different people, right? Y'all know better than the other people that y'all think y'all better than, right? Okay, just saying. Like, y'all doing this same shit. I ain't heard none of y'all call out Johnny Doc. I don't hear none of y'all tell y'all favorite progressive candidates to stay away from Johnny Doc. Period. Period. So, just putting that out there. So, there seems to be a lot that's been going on outside of Philly, but in courthouses where I am just sitting here, not surprised, but disgusted. So I don't know if you all, well, probably you do, heard about Danny Masterson. Danny Masterson was Masterson. He is an actor. He's 47. He was on that hit show, That's So 70s Show. Which I remember watching when I was, like, in middle school. And I guess that was a very popular show, right? Danny Masterson was on That 70s Show and was a very popular, you know, actor on that show with Ashton Kutcher, you know, Mina Kunis. Everybody was a part of that show. And, you know, this man was sentenced to rape, and he's going to be in prison for a while. So Masterson was
sentenced on Thursday to 30 years to life in prison for sexually assaulting two women at his Hollywood Hills home 2 decades ago. And it's come out. And the weird part is that there were celebrities that wrote letters defending him. And, you know, the two people that shockingly did that was Mila Kunis and Ashton Kutcher. They said they are aware of the pain that their letters, their character letters defending convicted rapist Danny Masterson caused, stating their intent was not to re-traumatize the victims or undermine the verdict. And, you know, they were among several other actors that did it. But they said in their statement was that we support victims. We have done this historically through our work and will continue to do so in the future, which is what Kunis said in an Instagram video. Now, the letters that were submitted to the court, they described Masterson as an outstanding older brother figure, dedicated and loyal husband, and an excellent role model, which is a stark contrast to the predator who drugged and raped defenseless women that his victims had labeled him as. They furthermore said in their letter that throughout our time together, Danny has proven to be an amazing friend, confidant, and above all, an outstanding older brother figure to me, Kunis wrote in her letter. His caring nature and ability to offer guidance have been instrumental in my growth, both personally and professionally. She went on to say that Masterson's role as a father and husband and father to his daughter have been nothing short of extraordinary. I mean, they're going on. And, you know, the letter is saying a lot. But they said that the letters were not written to question the legitimacy of the judicial system or the validity of the jury's ruling, is what they added. They said they were intended for the judge to read and not to undermine the testimony of the victims or re-traumatize them in any way. We would never do that, and we're sorry if that has taken place. Child, please. This reminds me of, you know, what's her name? Iggy Azalea writing letters with Mario in support of Tory Lanez. When Tory Lanez was convicted of assaulting Meg Thee Stallion. We've heard this song before. We know the optics. We know how this is being read. We understand what the perception is. And to be quite honest, we're not fooled. It's been brought up that Ashton Kutcher and Mila Kunis is also part of the House of Scientology. And, you know, Leah Remini, who is a former member of the Church of Scientology, not the House of Scientology, interesting. She's an outspoken critic of it. You know, she shared her thoughts. And to be clear, while Scientology was not directly involved in this trial, Masterson and the defendants were all members of the church at the time the incidents occurred. Now, you know, Leah Remini, you know, she basically came out and, you know, she said, you know, she left the church in 2013 and she is suing it and their leader, David Miscavige, alleging harassment and emotional distress with among those in attendance during Masterson's sentencing. And she published a statement on social media. She basically said that for over 2 decades, Danny Masterson avoided accountability for his crimes. While Danny was the only one sentenced, his conviction and sentence are indictments against Scientology. And she is calling it out on its operatives in Miscavige. You know, she, you know, has, you know, the Church of Scientology, by the way, has denied allegations about how the church has harassed the accusers. And they've claimed that those allegations have been debunked. And in a statement that they've put out previously, they said that church policy explicitly demands Scientologists abide by all laws of the land and all allegations to the contrary are totally false. So there's some conflicting, you know, ideas around it. All I'm going to say is interesting. 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 Yeah. All I will say as well is that Mila Kunis, girl, what are you doing? Ashton Kutcher, canceled. Okay. Y'all out here getting punked in real life. How y'all? Let me be quiet. Again, disgusted. Just side-eyeing the whole situation. So moving along, there is an Ask Ernest this week. You all have been in love with this Ask Ernest. Let me pull up the request. This was a really good one. So, not gonna name names, but I appreciate it. They said, don't use my real name. I'm not using your real name. They said, let me read it verbatim. I have an Ask Ernest question. If you have time to answer it at all in any of your future podcast episodes, I'd really appreciate it. Please don't use my real name, LOL. I'm not, girl. I got you. Rishi said, recently, one of my uncles died from complications related to alcoholism. He was only 50, but unfortunately, he had been drinking heavily for many years to self-medicate to deal with with trauma he experienced growing up. My father has told me that he does not want me to tell members of the extended family that he died for alcoholism, probably because of the shame. At his funeral service, there was no mention of the fact that alcoholism killed him. I understand that there was a lot of shame around alcoholism, but it feels almost dishonest to not tell family the truth of his death. For one, having a family member with alcoholism means that you have a higher likelihood of developing addiction. But also, hiding the truth of someone dying from alcohol abuse only furthers the stigma and shame, and it makes it so others do not get help. I understand that my uncle and other people from my family are older generation who did not have access to mental health services. But I feel like it's the responsibility of us millennials and Gen Zs to not be afraid to expose these family secrets. What do you think, Ernest? Is there a way to be honest about my uncle's battle with alcoholism without bringing shame on my old school black family? Or should I just zip it? Thanks in advance for any insight. Also, side note, my family has also kept family secrets about domestic violence and other problematic things, not just alcoholism. So it's definitely a pattern. Well, thank you for your question. That is a very good question and a very complicated one. I just appreciate how you all reach out to me and send me these questions. That's a really good question. Okay, here what I would do. Here's what I think. I think that this is a family matter, first and foremost. When I think about the show I watched, Queen Sugar, where, Nova was on Queen Sugar, and Nova was basically like, what was Nova saying? Nova Bordelon had this very interesting situation where she wanted to write a book and she didn't really run the issues with her family. It was her truth, but it involved members of her family. And she released the book, and the family was in shambles because they were like, there's things in my life that I didn't need you fucking telling. That's not your story to tell, even if it involves you. How dare you? In this situation, this is a very family-centered situation. And I think that you should have individual conversations with family members about the real cause of the death. I think you shouldn't, post this on social media. You shouldn't publish it. But I do think that you should, amongst family members, have these conversations. And if some of the old school folks don't want to have it, that's fine. But you can build a cohort of younger members in the family that you're worried about, that you're concerned about. Because you're right, the research shows that families that are dealing with alcoholism or have an alcohol family, that it's almost, I don't want to say hereditary, but if you're in a culture where you've seen and experienced that, the research shows that the likelihood for you to participate in similar things is very high. So this is trying to break a family curse or break a family cycle, right? Generational curses, right? If there's alcoholism in your family, issues like that, in there has to be intervention. And so what I would recommend is
trying to offer maybe potentially having an intervention, family counseling, right? Maybe there needs to be family counseling so that you don't have to put this burden on your shoulder, that maybe this is a process for healing. Maybe you should call an intervention and probably use resources to say, look, you know what? Some people in this family may not want to reconcile with this and deal with this, but offer the branch and opportunity to other members of the family to come together to bridge these divides and to heal. Because at the end of the day, I don't think your intent is to air dirty laundry, so don't. But at the same time, I also recognize that for you, keeping things in cobwebs does not make the family stronger. It actually divides the family and also can create and perpetuate the same generational curses that has led to this man's death. That's unfortunate. And my condolences to your uncle and to your family. But I do agree with you that there is a middle ground here and there's a dance here. And I think that you should identify members in your family that you feel safe to have these conversations with. And it seems like you have, but you should share it and you should discuss it. And I think you should also be willing to consider bringing in professional counseling and, you know, help to this, to offer therapy. Because to be clear, your family, your old school family members, while they might be a little old school and it might be annoying, they're still family and they still care. And maybe this is an opportunity to say, listen, you can't deal with this and grieve with this alone. We need to come together, and it might require a third party and an independent voice, a professional independent voice to help with that. So that's my recommendation. I hope that makes sense and that, you know, you move forward and keep us updated here on Earnestly Speaking. So thank you. Okay, going into movies, I just want to say that The Equalizer 3 with Denzel Washington, oh my God, it is so good. Okay, so I'm normally not into sequels and action films, but anything that Denzel was in, okay, like, that's my uncle in my head. I'm here for it. And I completely forgot to talk about going to see it. It is the bomb. I recommend people watch the previous two if you can. You don't really have to be honest, because each Equalizer has like its own story. But I feel like it's important to watch the first two just to understand Denzel's character a lot better and understand why this third and final part of the story is out. Denzel's film got number one at the box office, and it's incredible to see someone at his level in the industry still out here doing blockbuster hits, still number one at the box office, and does not have to do a Marvel fucking film to do it. That's what I'm talking about. One of the things I love about Denzel is that he's never did it. And you know what? Everybody like to talk about Leonardo DiCaprio, but mad props to Denzel and Leonardo DiCaprio for not getting in a fucking Marvel suit or a DC comic suit. And I ain't trying to throw shade, because sometimes you can be great, like, you know, Angela Bassett, and get an Oscar nomination for your performance in a Marvel film. But Angela Bassett is the only actor in all of these Marvel films to ever get an Oscar nomination. So shout out to her for pulling that off. Disney, where was Payola? We want our girl to get the Oscar, okay? Y'all should have had that campaign money ready. Jamie Lee Curtis, love you. But baby, let's be real. You wasn't even the best supporting actress in your own film, okay? Let's not act like, you know, my good Judy over there, who was Stephanie, okay, Zhu, who was also in that film, was the better supporting actress in that damn film, okay? Jamie Lee Curtis got the Oscar. Congratulations. But let's talk about it. Y'all know Stephanie up in Everything Everywhere All at Once was the better supporting performance than Jamie Lee Curtis. And she was also nominated. And so my thing is, when I saw that Angela Bassett didn't get the award, it should have went to Stephanie then, to keep it 100. But I digress. I'm not going to rehash it. But shout out to Denzel for continuing to do well at the box office without having to put on a cape. On to music. This song, Bongos by Cardi B and Meg Thee Stallion. It was a choice. Gorgeous swimsuits. Lovely swimsuits. Lovely choreography. I'm happy Meg is back. Okay, moving on.
So the MTV Music Awards is going to happen this week. It's on a freaking Tuesday. This is bizarre. The whole thing is bizarre. I don't even understand what's going on here. But the MTV Music Video Awards is happening on a Tuesday. I initially told you I wasn't enthusiastic about it, but now I'm a little excited because it looks a little messy. You know, honestly, I don't understand why they have Nicki Minaj hosting this shit again. Last year, the shit was weird because it was like, well, it wasn't that weird because she also was the video Vanguard Award winner. So that was kind of cool, I suppose. She won the MTV Video Vanguard Award for her music videos, which have been, you know, iconic, more so in the earlier part of her career versus now. But she was there and she presented, she performed Super Freaky Girl when it first came out. It was a number one hit on the Billboard charts. And now the song and the video is nominated for Video of the Year. And she's back again hosting the show while being a nominee and a performer. And it's just kind of like, interesting. But my whole thing is, who asked for that? Like, why? Is that the only way? See, this is what happens when big stars don't show up to award shows. Then people like Nicki didn't host it, right? I just think it's weird. But what made me interested is that Cardi and Meg Thee Stallion are clearly on a campaign to get this song number one or debut high on the charts. I think Bongos is going to do numbers. I think it's going to chart high on the Billboard Hot 100. I don't know if it's going to be number one. It'll be fascinating if it is. But I can definitely see it, you know, getting in the top five or the top 10. And, you know, it's not WAP. WAP is a classic. This is something different. I'll leave it there. But, you know, it's going to be interesting for them to perform it. It's a hot new song. You know, the VMAs has always been a place for artists who got new music coming out in the fall to oftentimes use the platform to promote the music in the fall. So this is an opportunity for them to promote the music, promote everything going on. And so I'm really excited about that aspect of this, that they're using, you know, they're going to promote the music. You know, Cardi's album is not coming in October, clearly. And she said that her album isn't, but it's obvious Cardi's ready to go back out there. And this is clearly the lead single for this new album. And she's clearly serious about dropping the album now. It looks like it's on and she's very back on focus and performing for the first time at the VMAs, this duo, like, this is awesome because we always want to WAP to be that moment, but it didn't happen because of the pandemic. So now we have this lovely opportunity. So I'm excited. I'm very excited. And I look forward to seeing, you know, what happens. I mean, I don't think that clearly Nicki is going to feel comfortable announcing Meg and Cardi. But I wonder what the energy is going to be with those teams. Because you remember the last time, you know, Cardi and Nicki were in the same room. This was at a fashion show where shoes were getting thrown and flown at. And, you know, Riley was out there and was messed, right? So I just hope that the ladies keep it cute. I hope that, you know, maybe there's a surprise opportunity for there to, you know, to be united because it's the 50th anniversary of hip hop. Like, I don't know, but I would love to see something different rather than the drama and the beef, but we don't know. Very interesting. Speaking of drama and beef, you know, TV has been very interesting. Following the Love and Hip Hop, you know, drama with everything with Erica Mena. Erica Mena still is in the conversation. She's still in the blogs. People are still talking about her. She's still in the conversation. People are still having opinions about, you know, some of the things she's been doing. And to be honest, you know, I'm personally looking like, you know, apparently there's a show she's on that's on Tubi. I don't even watch this show. But they said that she's not going to stay as a cast member based on what she recently did. The backlashes continue. Like, they are making an example of Erica Mena based on her anti-Black racist-ass remarks. And, you know, watching this week's episode of Love & Hip Hop Atlanta, you know, I'm watching how these episodes unfold. And you're starting to see that these cast members really do feel some type of way about what she said. And I've never seen the show really have a moment where everybody is, like, really taking a moment to unpack what has happened. I thought it was just going to be a one and done moment, but this has really carried on throughout the show and the series. And it makes so much sense why VH1
and Eric and Mona Scott Young decided to pull the plug on her, because it's obvious that this has had a life of its own and that this issue is not going to just be it. And honestly, Erica should apologize. I'm just not seeing any apology, because everybody keeps pulling the my son, my child should be mentioned. But okay, then let Spice go low and then let Spice deal with it. But nowhere should it ever be justified to be racist. Like, calling a black woman a monkey and you are not black, you are doing something that's racist, and no one can make you racist. Let me tell you something. I have encountered women who have called me all kinds of homophobic slurs and insults. And never in those encounters have I ever decided that that would be the moment that I'll be a sexist and degrade a woman on her gender. Never happened. I have encountered racist trans people, racist trans people. And never have I ever decided to be transphobic in that moment, because that's not who I am. And so there is no excuse for racist behavior based on other behavior. If somebody gets racist with you, you don't get sexist back. You don't become homophobic in that moment. You don't become transphobic. Like, that's not okay. You don't respond with hate with hate. If that's who you are, that's who you are. And I say this because when I look at Erica Mena, right, in conversation with Spice, when Erica Mena called Spice a monkey, Spice never called her any racial slur pertaining to her identity as a Latinx woman. She didn't get racist back. She didn't make any type of problematic racist ass jokes or remarks. So let's be real here, that if it's not in you, anything will not make you anything, unless this is who you already have been and who you already are. And there's been reports that this is not the first time Erica Mena has had an issue with anti-blackness. And I can believe it, because if she felt that comfortable to call this black woman a monkey multiple times while even making monkey sounds, then this means this person has this in their DNA. And that's that. So in wrapping up this podcast episode, I want to just remind everyone that I want people that around this time, I don't know if she's listening to the podcast or she's probably going to listen afterwards, but I want to personally give a congratulations to my fave, my bestie, Amanda Parks, who is about to be Dr. Amanda Parks, because she is defending her dissertation defense presentation, which is happening, you know, probably around the time some of you are listening to this episode. And I'm super excited to be able to support and listen and be there. And I'm very proud. And we're going to go out and eat the types of food that she loves. And also, I left out another restaurant that I went to that just hit me now. I went to Cantania. What is that place? It's a Mexican place. It's called Cantania La Marina in Kensington. And it's a Mexican restaurant with authentic Mexican flavor and lots of great drinks. I want to tell you all up front, what was interesting about that experience was that I went to Cantina La Marina, which is on 2800 D Street, which is in the heart of Kensington. That inside of that restaurant is joy, incredible Mexican flavor, lots of great margaritas or popsicles, just great drinks all around. But outside, it's really real. And it's a lot. And it was very interesting because I haven't been to Kensington in a while, but I was in that area and I was like, wow, there's a lot happening outside this restaurant. And just reminding me how important it is that the city really does do something about what's happening in Kensington in the crisis. But I would say that this Mexican restaurant needs your support. Go there, eat there, support it, check it out. It's the best Mexican food I've had in Philadelphia. And I'm not lying to you. It's incredible. Me and my fave, Amanda, will be going to another Mexican restaurant in Fishtown, We're going to have some tequila and some shots, some good times. And I'm just really happy and proud of her. And if you all know her, my good friend, tell her congratulations. And she's worked really hard to get to this point. And I can't wait to, cheer her on this week. So congratulations, Dr. Parks. And I look forward to just the week in general. There's so many awesome opportunities and surprises, things happening. More new restaurant tastings. I'm just into it. Restaurant week is upon us. It's going to be really fun. A lot of different things are happening. And I'm super excited. And, you know, it's been great. So, as always, be well and be best.
Earnestly Speaking is recorded in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and can be found on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts. To stay up to date with the latest on the show, follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Mr. Ernest Owens. Use the hashtag Earnestly Speaking to tell me what you thought about this episode, and check out my website at ErnestOwens.com.